This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And boy, oh boy, do you want to know the story behind this book today? I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Al Marr, and the name of her book is The Family Bones. And this is one scary book. Hi, Al.
Hi, Patsy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, I'm happy you're not off going in labor.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what
exactly.
Last time.
Yeah, I still looked forward to speaking with you, and then I went into labor delivering my second child. You know, sometimes those agendas don't line up with book publishing. I don't know.
I know. You know. Babies aren't supposed to arrive on release date. You know, a release date is big enough as it is without a baby.
Exactly. I knew it would be close, and by God, it was.
It was. But it's so wonderful to talk to you. I don't know.
Thank you again for having me.
Well, I think your writing is terrific. I don't know if people can appreciate that of all the genres, you know, we have cozy mysteries, we have mysteries, we have thrillers, but there's nothing really quite as difficult to write as a suspense thriller, because
you have to
be on your game with that. It's not easy. You know, with cozy mysteries, the writers can sprinkle around Easter eggs along the way, and the readers have fun, you know, trying to, you know, remember things. Does it matter that the girl wore a yellow scarf? So those are relatively, you know, they're fun, but it's not what you have to do. And you.
I love cozy mysteries, but you're absolutely right. There's a different underlying element to suspense thrillers that takes some plotting for me. Some people, I'm sure, are able to just pull it out of a hat, but I have to be very meticulous in how I lay my breadcrumbs.
Oh yeah, I mean you do, and you are absolutely one of the best at it, and that's why I was so happy to see that Publishers Weekly gave you that coveted starred review, and they call it a mesmerizing, I love that word, a mesmerizing psychological thriller.
Yes, thank you so much. I loved that review. I was so pleased to see the starred review, and it was so nice to have that industry recognition, because I truly love this book, and it was so much fun to write while pregnant, as it happened.
And it's really... You know, you're so sweet. You're such a sweet girl.
Oh, thank you.
But you've got such a wicked mind.
That's what I want. I want the juxtaposition. I want nice up front, wicked in the back.
You got it. You got it, Gail. Oh, wow. Say about a thriller, a suspense thriller. You don't want to give anything away. So your spiel, what you want to tell people, but then we're going to leave them hanging, and they have to get this book and find out. And have a very, let's say, especially if they're reading it at night, have a nice blanket around your shoulders so you can sort of snuggle in you shiver.
Yeah. Well, that's a high compliment. I hope that readers do shiver and that they do cozy up with a nightlight afterward. It's The Family Bones is a locked room thriller set in the mountains of Eastern Oregon, where a family reunion among psychopaths goes horribly wrong, as they are wont to do, right? And then you throw in my true crime podcaster, Birdie Tan, who obsesses over cold cases that the media miss, and I'm hoping that it creates a compelling read for readers.
Oh, it's compelling, all right. And I'm glad you mentioned Birdie right up front, because she's one heck of a good character.
Oh, thank you. I really out of all the characters that I write, sometimes people ask me who would I actually hang out with, who would I grab a drink with, or you know, have a book club with, and it would be Birdie off the bat. I love her.
Well, thank I you. Agree. I would love to have a drink with her.
She's got stories.
She's got
a true crime podcaster, and she sees all kinds of stuff and pursues all kinds of information.
And I must say, as I got into her character, I thought to myself, I don't know, is somebody planning a series? Because you could bring her back for a lot of, she's, as you said, she's got a lot of stories to tell.
She does. Prequels and sequels, I think she would have a lot to work with.
So now we're here in this reunion. I'm just thinking back to our only really big family reunion a number of years ago. We have sort of a county in northern Michigan where everybody's a cousin. So it was like, it wasn't just a family reunion. It was like the entire county got together.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
We didn't have anything quite as exciting as in this book, thank goodness.
Thank goodness. That's great. That's how they should go.
Exactly. So what do you want to tell about, how much do you want to give away? People, you have to read this book.
Yes, people, please read this book. I will just wet a little whistle, a few whistles here and there. It's a family reunion among psychopaths. However, that's not to say that everyone there is some kind of caricature. This book is really something that I tried to, a theme throughout my books is mental health. And it touches, my books often touch on that subject. And others, like The Family Bones, spend a little bit more time with it. This is particularly about psychology, in that one of my main characters, Olivia Erickson, is a psychology doctoral candidate. And so she comes from a long line of the Erickson's, a family that exhibits hallmarks of antisocial personality disorder. That's the umbrella above psychology, or psychopathy. The umbrella above sociopathy. And so these are traits and conditions that tend to run in her family, but that's not to say that everyone is neurodivergent. Many of them are, you know, quote unquote, normal people out in society, neighbors, volunteers at animal shelters, you know, they're regular people. However, there is some capacity for something else lurking in their genes. And that's what a lot of this book is about, questioning, is it nature or is it nurture that's more important? And I would be curious to see what readers think the answer is at the end of this, or if, you know, the book didn't change their mind at all, that's fine as well. But there's a lot of fun little psychology tidbits from this graduate student Olivia's perspective on the rest of her family.
So, well, I found her fascinating too. And when you think about it, she knew what she was getting into. In one way, you know, yes. when you accept that invitation to the family reunion, you know you're in for more than strawberry shortcake.
Well put. Exactly. More than just a yearbook that you sign afterwards.
And she's got a new love in her life. And
absolutely.
So for him, he's got to experience it too.
Yeah, he's kicking the tires pretty hard on whether or not he wants to join this family. Her fiance, Howard, truly is dying to meet his future in-laws. And Olivia has held him at bay regarding meeting them. And so she views this opportunity to reunite with her family at this mountain resort as the next step in their relationship, and certainly one that he has been asking for. And she loves them. She is her family for all intents and purposes. He is the person that she goes to with her emotional needs and for, you know, Chinese takeout together. And they are all that the other person needs. However, she recognizes that, you know, Howard wants to know what he is, where she comes from exactly, without any judgment, because he knows of her family's background. But he wants to know the whole picture of his fiance, whom he loves dearly, and you know, in his mind, nothing would ever change that. So it's really about, for him, further cementing their relationship, which I think adds an emotional stake to the whole scenario.
Oh, definitely. I love when you said he was dying to meet them. Just that's a good choice of words. Okay. Sometimes maybe you shouldn't be dying to meet people so much.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you should step back and check out Googling first.
Yeah. Might be a good idea, but so you had fun building up the story. Well, first of all, the backstories are so twisty and so turny.
Thank you, that's
just great. But on the other hand, you also have to just put a feel for the location. Tell us where they are and then why they get stuck there.
Absolutely. And I, speaking of backstory, something else that the readers might not be aware of, or sorry, listeners might not be aware of at first, the Family Bones has a different kind of storytelling structure, and that I include newspaper articles about various members of the Erickson family, if they made the news, if they did something that was newsworthy, criminal or otherwise. And, so there is a lot of backstory to try and inform the reader as they go through of who they're talking with or who they're watching and what they're observing as the story unfolds. And they are set, the mountain resort retreat is set in eastern Oregon, actually in a real national preserve, the Malheur Forest, which actually means unfortunate or bad luck in French. Which I thought was pretty fun. I was just looking on Google Maps to figure out where exactly this family reunion should be set or what I should be inspired by. And I found the Malheur Forest and thought, well, that is just too perfect.
Well, yeah, I mean, for somebody who went to the Sorbonne and studied and, studied in Paris, I guess that just that grabbed you right away.
Yeah, I couldn't resist. I absolutely couldn't resist. And I thought it was a fun little Easter egg that in French it does make bad luck. Poor bad luck just to go to that family reunion in this exact spot. So an atmospheric river rolls in, as I think many of us across the country are familiar with that term these days, an atmospheric river rolls in, kind of a massive storm that shut down the roads, caused mudslides in the area. Oregon is now subject to a lot of changes in its climate patterns, and so there are a lot more mudslides and forest fires that create, of course, more mudslides thereafter. And so everything kind of comes together in this quote perfect storm, actual storm, to isolate the family reunion at this mountain resort. So the family is with the resort staff. They try to go about their business, but of course with the inclement weather and the tensions that begin to rise, being all shut in together, it becomes a locked room thriller where we don't really know what's going to happen among all of these interesting personalities.
A little homage to Agatha Christie.
Absolutely. I mean, everything's an homage to Agatha Christie, right? Everything should be.
And, well, as they get knocked off... this book is really, you have so many levels to it, and I do love having the news stories, and also I like that kind of thing tucked into a book. It for me it's it makes it very vivid.
Oh, thank you. That's so wonderful to hear. Thank you.
Yeah,
my intent.
Yeah, that was a good device. You in a few quick little stories, you tell a lot. You pack a punch just like a newspaper article does. Who, what, when, and where, and you got it. And so that really sets the tone, I think, for the book. And I enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you. That's so great to hear. I felt the same way. And not to toot my own horn, but across like other books that I read, I just love when I'm reading a book, I just love to dive into that world and then to learn as many layers of that world as possible. It just becomes so much more vivid and so much more like a, what's the word? Just like a vision transferred from the author into the reader's mind, myself as the reader, And I love imparting that kind of mental telepathy to my readers. And I certainly hope that I achieve that effect.
Well, I think you do. And that's why I say that it will give you some shivers, and but it keeps people turning the pages. Some of it is, well, I can't give it away. I mean, that's a problem.
It's sort of, it is a thriller.
It is a thriller. You got to read it. It's sort of like, what was it? Missing Sister. I couldn't say what was happening in the beginning. I wanted people to read it to just find out what was going to happen.
Yes.
And of course,
I agree.
I love that one because it was set in Paris, which you know so well.
Absolutely. Yeah, my debut, The Missing Sister, was, speaking of homages, was definitely an homage to Paris. It was a love letter to, you know, one of my favorite cities in the world. And I continue to hope that readers walk away from that book with the sense that I do love that city and all of its beautiful, sparkling icons, as well as some of the darker, seedier locales.
I know, but everything about Paris. I used to go there probably every other weekend when I lived in England. Now, of course, that was before your time. You're young. You don't remember the American Express office, do you?
I do not.
Well, in my days, we had to go to the American Express office to make telephone calls to America.
Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm. we would have to wait, and we would have to, there would be a booth. And it's so funny when I think about it now that when I get to Paris and I'd want to call my dad in America, I would have to go and I'd have to, make arrangements for a time, and I'd have to wait by the booth until the call came through.
That's so interesting. So, I did not know about the American Express office.
Oh, everything. Well, that's where we would get our mail, would be sent to the American Express office, because that's what they did for us. It was absolutely beautiful.
Absolutely. And I feel like there's a story there.
Huh?
I feel like there's a book waiting to come out of this experience.
Oh, yes. It was wonderful. And I spent a lot of time there. Well, of course, my husband and I probably stayed in fancy hotels than you as a student did.
I'm sure.
We used to do the Maurice quite often. But it was wonderful time that I spent in Paris, and I loved when you were writing about it and how you took me there. It was I found a lot of joy in reading that. You know, although it was a thriller and a mystery and everything, suspense, the Paris part was so important to the book.
Oh, that is the highest compliment. Whenever any reader that has been to Paris and reads The Missing Sister and says that the setting brought back memories to them, that is the highest form of praise for me, and truly across my settings, but particularly in Paris. So thank you for that. That's such a nice compliment.
And I always wanted to ask you, how did you land up going there? How lucky was that, or planned, or fortuitous, or what?
Definitely fortuitous. I had a quarter-life crisis when I was 25, and I decided I wanted to move to France. And so I just found a teaching job that then led to another teaching job that then led to me saying, you know what, I'd actually like to deepen my understanding of the French language and culture and also my education. And so I applied to the Sorbonne. I had to take a test to prove that I could speak French fluently and also study in French fluently and write and all of that. So I had to take a couple of tests, and then I was accepted to the Sorbonne. So it was fortuitous on so many levels. But it happened after about 3 years of living there. So it was a kind of the culmination of a few different dreams.
Well, it paid off. It paid off in that book, and I'm sure it's going to pay off in a thing. And it even paid off in finding the perfect location for this strange family. And as I said, it is a perfect location. It's funny, where I'm from in Copper Country in Michigan, we have a place called Misery Bay. And that's where we used to go for picnics. But we didn't hold a family reunion. We didn't hold a family reunion there, luckily, because maybe we would have landed up with a few bodies. Not that we had. We did
that's
have
a fantastic contrast.
Exactly.
Misery Bay.
Well, you are a fantastic writer, and I just, you know, I always so I'm get such a kick out of a writer who has found this passion and this ability to really, when you said you want people to see it, I of course saw it the way I always see a book that I love. I see it in my head. I as a film for me, as I'm reading, sometimes I forget, and which is actually scary in your case, because if I forget and I start thinking it's real, and every creak in the house, every door.
Yeah, that
gets a little intense.
Yeah, again, very high praise. It's not something I take pride in exactly, but it is a huge compliment that people think about the writing. And then maybe when the lights are off, the certain images come back, because that's how I feel about certain books, and that's when I know I've read something good. So thank you for sharing that, and I'm sorry.
No. It's we need, you know, sometimes we need that. It's better. Let's put it this way. If I have a choice at 11 o'clock at night to be reading your book or watching the news, I will take your book anytime, because the news is so much worse.
Yeah, there's a conclusion to my stories usually.
Exactly.
It ends.
Exactly. And some people are just dying to read it. So.
Well, I hope so. I would be very honored.
Okay. So where can people find out more about you, your website, social media do you like to do, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely. I am across all social media platforms, or most of them, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I'm very active on Instagram. And then also on TikTok for anyone else who's discovering that platform, as I did a couple of years ago. And then at elmar.com, my website, elmar.com, has all the information and all the links that you could possibly want.
Well, I think you're fantastic, Elle. I really do. And I'm so happy. What did you finally name the baby? I never heard. Number two.
Ivy. Her name is Ivy.
Oh, I love that name. That is so cool. Yeah. I love that name. As a matter of fact, I was going to tell you, I like the name Olivia, too, for the main character in this book.
I love the name Olivia. And every time I name a character, I think, Is this my character's name, or is this the name I want for my future child?
Well, I'm glad that you didn't go into labor today. Although maybe you're going to start birthing a new birdie book. Are you working on a new book?
Oh,
I'm sure.
My goodness, I am. I absolutely am. Thank you. I actually just finished writing my manuscript, and I sent it off to my editor. It's called The Alone Time. The Alone Time. And it's a plane crash thriller, kind of like Yellow Jackets, which meets Karen Slaughter's Pretty Girls. And that's coming out in spring 2024.
And you'll be right back here then.
I hope so. I hope to be invited back, Cassie.
Oh, you're invited back anytime you want. As a matter of fact, you can just come on the program just for the heck of it and talk about writing, because actually you could give a lot of information to all of those people that I talk about at the beginning of the program who are dreaming of writing. They have to, if they're dreaming of writing suspense books, you should come on the program and give my listeners some hints. How about that?
Oh, I would love that.
Okay, but I'm going to make sure you're not going to go into labor. Okay.
Yeah, we'll coordinate.
Okay. Great talking to you, Elle.
Thanks so much, Patsy.
Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, I like her so much. She's so sweet. Okay, we're going to have a book buzz, a very special one. It's a little bit, it's about a book from an author who has a new book out. And so we don't have a book buzz for the new book, but we're going to have one next week when Rita Moreau comes in here, and she's going to do a book buzz, a new book buzz for Tim Dorsey's The Maltese Iguana, which is just came out last week. But here's one for one of his other books.
Hey, this is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery from Florida's King of Mayhem. Best-selling author Tim Dorsey's The Pope of Palm Beach is another madcap adventure. Here's the buzz. No one worships the Sunshine State as much as Serge A. Storms. Perpetually hunting Floridian arcana and lore, he and his permanently baked sidekick, Coleman, are on the road again. This time, they're on a frenzied literary pilgrimage that leads them back to Riviera Beach, the cozy seaside town where the boys spent their formative years. Growing up, Serge was enthralled by the legend of Riviera Beach, also known as Darby, a wilder at the port who surfed the local waves long before the hot spots were hot. A god on the water, the big-hearted surfer was a friend to everyone. The younger surfers, cops, politicians, wealthy businessmen, and ordinary Joes. A generosity of spirit that earned him the admiration of all. Meanwhile, there was a much murkier legend that made the rounds of the schoolyards from Serge's youth. That of the crazy hermit living in a makeshift jungle compound further up the mysterious Loxahatchee River than anyone dared to venture. Then Serge moved away, but never forgot. Now he's back, with those legends looming larger than ever in the rearview mirror of his memory. As his literary odyssey moves north from Key West, closer and closer to his old stomping grounds, Serge digs into the past as only Serge can. Along the way, he unintentionally disturbs some long-forgotten ground, attracting the attention of a cast of villains that only Florida can produce. As the body count grows, so does the list of questions. Fans of wacky crime fiction will have plenty of fun with The Pope of Palm Beach, a witty and deliciously violent delight from the twisted imagination of Tim Dorsey. This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions, go to our webpage, www.radio-joyonpaper.com, and click on Book Buzz. That's radio-joy on paper. Rita Moreau, buzzing off for now.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And this is going to be fun because I have a love-hate relationship with lawyers. And he's a lawyer. I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, William Landay. It's his first visit to Joy on Paper, and it's not going to be his last because I know he's writing. Hi, William Landay. Are you there?
Hi, I'm here. How are you?
Okay. Do you like to be called William or Bill?
Bill is fine. Thank
Bill.
You.
Okay. I thought you sounded like a Bill. well, maybe then this is psychological, probably. As I mentioned, I have this love-hate relationship with lawyers. And I love lawyers who become authors. I just had last week Steve Barry on, and of course, as you know, he was a mm-hmm. lawyer for 30 years. And of course, the wonderful thing is being a lawyer, you really learn how to use words. And then when you decide to use your cases as a jumping start for a book, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's one of the reasons that lawyers make such natural writers, and that transition happens often. It's not just that you're good with words, but the cases that are crossing your desk give you material. It's the stuff of fiction, and it's right in front of you.
Exactly. And all those characters that you meet along the way, especially in your case, of course, you were a district attorney, so you came across a lot of strange characters.
Well, that's for sure. And you certainly do draw on that. I would caution, though, that I'm always careful about not drawing on actual cases too closely. I always feel that the victims of crimes never volunteered to be in the public eye. And so I don't like to victimize them twice. So while you do draw on your experience, I try never to draw on specific cases if I can avoid it.
And also, you don't want to be sued by another lawyer. Because they will.
Very true.
Very true. You know it. As I said, I have this love-hate relationship. I went through a terrible lawsuit once. Well, twice. But
Oh, yes.
That's why I'm here in Florida, on the west coast of Florida instead of the west coast of California, because I got involved in a lawsuit. But maybe we'll get back to that after we talk about your wonderful new book, All That Is Mine, I Carry With Me. Well, you know, when you wrote Defending Jacob, that came out before I started Joy on Paper. I would have had you on for that one because it won so many awards, and it was really great. So I'm so happy that you're finally here on Joy on Paper with this new book. So tell us about it.
So the book is about, it's about another criminal case involving a family from the same Boston suburb where Defending Jacob is set. And to some extent, it's a mirror image of Defending Jacob. Defending Jacob was about parents and their anxiety about not knowing and not understanding their child. This is a book about children not knowing and maybe not trusting their own father. So a young girl, 8 years old, comes home from school one day in the 1970s to find her mother missing. Her father is a criminal defense attorney and immediately becomes a suspect in this woman's disappearance. But the case essentially goes unsolved. There's no evidence. And so the book is really about the long shadow of this case and the toll it takes on this family, especially the children.
And
I'll leave it there because I don't want to add too many spoilers.
That's a problem with this. You've laid the premise out. We know there's going to be a lot of things happening, layers of with the children, layers with the father, layers with the policeman involved, there are these wonderful layers, and then you get to play around with them.
Yes, and in fact, it's a very untraditional crime novel. It's about a case that does not get solved, which defies the conventions of the genre, which is generally about detectives of one kind or another running around, gathering up clues, and then at the end of the story, solving the crime, which is satisfying, but which there's only so much you can do with at this point. So this is about doubt. It's about not knowing, which is very true to the experience of actual crime. I do find that the crime novels tend to get a little repetitive, and there's only so much you can do to breathe life into the genre at this point. So this is really a genre-bending kind of book. It's told in a fragmented, inventive way, and it's really about the relationships of this family. I always say that I'm not a crime novelist. I don't write crime novels. I write novels that happen to be about crime. To me, my books are really family dramas and human dramas, and that's really where my interest lies.
Definitely family dramas, and one of your main characters who comes into the story and sort of brings it about. Tell us about Philip Solomon.
Philip Solomon is a writer who bears a striking resemblance to William Landay. He is a writer who has had success but hasn't been able to. He says that he is not blocked, but for one reason or another, he came to write. And so the book opens from Bill Landay, and the idea of putting a character in there who resembles the author so closely is to lean into the realism of the novel and the authenticity. I want readers to have a sense that this book and this story is so real and so honest that there must be elements of truth about it. I think we live in a moment when everybody is so skeptical and so cynical about the misinformation that's around. But it's very hard for us to dive into a novel the way we might have been able to once. So one way, I think, to address that and to meet the modern reader where she is to present a book that is honest and that feels too real to ignore. And so that's one thing that I'm trying to address.
Well, I think it works. And he,
thank you.
You know, you drew us into the story, made a compelling reason for us to continue reading, for us to discover about the people involved. And as you said, it's difficult nowadays with everything going on in the world. And you wrote this, what you must have been writing this in the pandemic period, and you know, and mm-hmm. all of that, and we're all crazy at the time anyway, and we still haven't recovered from it. It's like this lingering thing, but it is good, I think, to have something like this. In a way, it's better than what we're going through at the moment.
It's true. It's true. It's the pandemic. It's the political instability. It's the media instability. It's also just the fact of this technology, these phones that are in our pockets that are pinging all day and that are flooding us with information in short bursts that trains us to surf and to skim and makes it very difficult for us to focus. We have kind of a fragmented, frantic attention span at this point. And novels, unfortunately, demand a kind of sustained focus that is more and more difficult to muster these days. And so it's not just the voice of the book, it's the way the book is structured, which invites the reader to participate in a very active way in reconstructing the story and to engage with the book. It really relies on the reader's skill in putting these puzzle pieces together. It's a book that is laid out for you in pieces, like a jigsaw puzzle, and trust the reader to assemble those pieces. And there's a kind of pleasure in that as well. Some of the best reading experiences that I've had are books that are built this way. I think of Ian McEwan's Atonement in particular, a book that was also told in sections like this and allowed the reader to put the pieces together and to feel that satisfaction of reconstructing the story herself.
Oh, I like the way you're using herself. Okay.
Well, we have to be honest. Most novel readers are women, aren't they?
Well, yeah, I don't know about, is it most now? Yeah, but I think for women who read this, and you're right, I mean, this, I think it's the entire family idea of what, you know, you're a mother and you, a mother disappears. That right away just invites women to read this novel and to imagine who did it or who didn't do it or what's going on, and carry the reader along with that underlying theme always of what happened to mommy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's one anxiety that every parent feels is, what would happen to my family if something were happened to me? And it's also true that all mothers were daughters at one point, and we all have shared the experience of either losing a parent or growing apart from a parent, if only in the sense that we grow up and we come to regard our parents as fellow adults, and we come to see our mothers and fathers as whole people with all the flaws and all the strengths that every complex person has. And that is what growing up is all about. And it's one thing that makes parent-child relationships so complicated and makes growing up complicated. And so in this book, what you have is the story of children who literally lose their mother. But we all have felt something like that, just as a normal part of growing up in an ordinary way. And so even though this may seem like a very dark and very unusual story, in a way it addresses a universal anxiety and a universal experience. And I think that readers are going to find this story very accessible and very relatable, even if they have no experience in crime or criminality. It's like Defending Jacob, a story that is only superficially about crime and is really much more about people and families and relationships.
Exactly. And I wanted to mention also, I liked what you did with the detective, Detective Glover. I like the nuance. Usually we don't get a lot of nuance with the detective, so I like that.
Yeah, he's the opposite of the cliche, hard-bitten noir detective. He's a sensitive guy, and like a lot of cops that I've known, in murder cases in particular, they care. They care deeply, and they form attachments to the families that are involved in these cases, and especially to the victims, even though the victim in a murder case, by definition, can't be known. Detective Glover, in this case, is committed in his heart to this case and to this victim. And even as the case stretches over years and years and years, he never lets go. And that, I think, is probably a more common experience than we non-cops are aware. There are, of course, hard-bitten detectives and cops out there, but there are people who feel the job in their heart as well.
Oh,
and
I think
that's one of the things that makes it demanding.
I think there are more like Detective Glover. They carry the cases, some of the cases, what they have to see, what they have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why they are sensitive people. And so that's why I really enjoyed his character. I thought you did a great job with him.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I always like, as I said, I love talking to lawyers when I'm at the microphone.
Lawyers who are off duty.
That's definitely off duty. I couldn't take another lawsuit for anything, because I unfortunately my lawyer was just out of law school.
Oh,
that was funny. And I think, you know, when you're just out of law school, it's not really a good idea to take on a case where you're facing nine lawyers from a movie company.
Oh my goodness! I'm sorry to hear it.
Yeah, that was a rookie mistake on my part and on his part. although probably now, you know, I'm not talking to him anymore. Maybe he's probably on the other side of the conference table now. He's one of the guys wearing the Italian loafers with no socks. And
where I live, it's very cold, so we wear socks up there.
Yeah, I was going to say you're not in Los Angeles, so you know that's you know when. When the first time it happened to me, and I realized that, my goodness, the lawyer who was on the other side of the conference table, not only was wearing, you know, $3,000 handmade Italian loafers with no socks, I knew I lost. My poor guy had a suit. I think he had just bought it from. Perhaps Sears. It was a funny experience. But love lawyers, and I'm glad that not only do you make money as a lawyer, you make money writing books. And
I'm retired as a lawyer. I haven't practiced law in 20 years.
Well, you're having fun, that's for sure. I can tell from your writing that you have these, as I said, when I get a book that's layered, I love it, and you've definitely accomplished something with this book. And
yeah, well, thank you.
You know,
my view has always been that the law and crime are really just prisms to look at human nature, and so these aren't books that are primarily about lawyers. They're just books that. Use the criminal cases as a way to dramatize experiences that we all know and that we all share.
Well, I think you've done a great job with this book, and it is called All That Is Mine I Carry With Me. And your characters, they all carry part of this story along in a fascinating way. As you said, it is so much... I think the readers will enjoy what I experienced, really working it out myself, what I thought and how I thought about it. So I'm really, really happy that you were on Joy on Paper today. And it's William Landay, right? And where you have a website, social media. Where do you want people to find you?
Well, the best place to start is williamlanday.com. It's last name is Landay. And you'll find all the information about all my books there, including links and everything you need.
And they definitely should, after they get this book, go back and read Defending Jacob. I know Defending Jacob won lots of awards and lots of things.
Yep.
But that's because it's so well written. And again, Bill, it was wonderful to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. All right. So what? It turned out to be a crime day. I didn't expect to have... This usually doesn't happen that I have two books about crime on the same program, but it just happened that way. And I thought, well, you know, that's pretty cool. And both of them, you know, as I was saying to Al Marr, her book is... an escape from reality, because, well, we hope it's not reality. We hope that it's not reality with this family of psychopaths. But it's funny to see how she can build up a story about a family that might not everyone's psychopath. So that's what, why you read the book. And again, she's wonderful, and William Landay is great. They're both great writers, and I was so happy that it worked out. It's that kind of day. And as a matter of fact, I'm shivering in here. I don't know if Big Ed is trying to freeze me, and if people are watching me on YouTube, I'm shaking because it's so cold in here. I don't know why. What is it so cold? But it's been a just a fun show. I sometimes get these shows where it just gives me a kick to have two things like this, two books at the same time about crime, because we all need diversion from what in the heck is going on in this world, or what in the heck is going on with baseball? Because I don't know what to do. I'm so upset about this changing the size of the bases. Ed, are you in there? What do you think about this changing the size of the bases? We didn't get to talk about it.
I don't know. They're just trying to promote scoring.
Well, that's not the way. It just irritates me. I almost to the point, you know, I love the Tigers, and I'm hoping for the, what do you mean? The Tigers need a bigger base? They didn't see it. It's cheating. It seems to me it's cheating because in the old days, when you got to that base, I mean, you stretched your leg as far as you could to touch that base, right?
Well, and I think the bigger base might cut down on injuries, too. In other words, less collisions.
With who?
With the guy that's trying to get him out.
Well, of course, that's the whole point of it is...
You got to remember, you're dealing with people that are paying somebody $200 million a year.
Yeah, but if you aren't ready to just slide in there and knock that other guy off... I don't know what I mean. It seems cheating. All the baseball games I saw, and all the Tigers games I saw, we sat behind first base. That my dad always had tickets for the right behind first base, which is why I got to meet so many famous baseball players and get kissed. But of course, I was little then. I was, you know, like 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and up until about the age of 10, 12, I would go to all these games and kiss all these baseball stars. I wish we had those cameras in those days with, you know, on your phone, and I would have those photos of me being kissed by all these famous baseball stars. But I think it's cheating. I don't like this base business. I think it's wrong. And that's my opinion. And I might still watch the Tigers in hopes, living in hope. That's what we call it in Detroit. We live in hope that one day the Tigers will win again. Anyway, you never know. I wanted just to remind everyone to go to my webpage, which is www.radio-joyonpaper. I have a lot of information up there about the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper, which is going to be next Thursday, March 16th. And I'm just reviewing some of the authors who have been on Joy on Paper and just giving them a nod. So check out my webpage. Meanwhile, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries, because my sister loves Aunt Ibby. That is one of the main characters in Carol's book, and my sister just relates to her. So a special hello to my sister Natalie today, because it's a special day for her too. Everybody, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed, because Ed is so nice, and he saluted me, I saluted him, and I should have been a general. I would have been a general. Oh boy, would I have. Oh, I just love to order people around. Right now, today, I'd take a flight to the Pentagon, and I'd start ordering everybody around. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. Bye-bye.